Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, December 7, 2015, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group teleforum conference call. We're talking about the Evenwell case today, which is going to be argued in the court tomorrow. I don't know how much of the introduction you missed, Dean McGrath, but you are our first speaker. Then we're going to hear from Brad Benbrook. So without anything further, the floor is yours, Mr. McGrath, for the first set of your opening remarks, if you could go right ahead.
Thank you. Let me start by, I think it's important to look at what the court postured the case as. And what they said in granting cert is, in Reynolds, the court held that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment includes a one-person, one-vote principle. The principle requires that when members of an elected body are chosen from separate districts, each district must be established on a basis that will ensure, as far as practical, that equal numbers of voters can vote for proportionally equal numbers of officials. They then cited Hadley versus Junior College District of Metro, Kansas City, Missouri, in support of that. And the narrow issue then they posted is the question presented is whether the one-person, one-vote principle of the 14th Amendment creates a judicially enforceable right, ensuring that the districting process does not deny voters an equal vote. So the first focus and probably the primary background for one person, one vote is the Supreme Court's decision in Reynolds versus Sims. And that case was the follow-on to the court's decision in Baker that established standing for challenging in voting rights cases. So in Reynolds, they follow Baker versus Carr, and they then focus on a challenge to an Alabama senatorial districting, which was brought by voters in Alabama that alleged there was a roughly 41-to-1 discrepancy between districts for eligible voters. And in a decision by Chief Justice Warren, the court determined that the 14th Amendment Section 1, that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws, that as part of that Section 1 equal protection provision, that there was a basically a right that derived from kind of the suffrage component that it requires substantially equal representation for all citizens, that weighing votes differently based where citizens reside is discriminatory, and that the House of Representatives, which are apportioned under Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, was not controlling. They then used that kind of background to conclude that the Equal Protection Clause guarantees the opportunity for equal participation by all voters in the election of state legislators. Diluting the weight of votes because of place of residence impairs basic constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment just as much as invidious discrimination based on factors such as race or economic status. So the court uses the Equal Protection Clause to create a quasi, I'm not going to use fundamental right in kind of the racial discrimination sense, but they essentially, that there is a core right under the Equal Protection Clause, and it's based in large part on the voting component of the clause, the voting component of it is the sine qua non for the clause. I think it's important to also note that in citing Hadley, which is decided 6 years later, the court in granting cert in Evanwell cites is, the court summarizes Reynolds for the following proposition. In an elaborate opinion in Reynolds, we called attention to prior cases indicating that a qualified voter has a constitutional right to vote in elections without having his vote wrongfully denied, debased, or diluted. We therefore held that the various state apportionment schemes denied some voters the right guaranteed by the 14th Amendment to have their votes given the same weight as that of other voters. And I think it's also worth noting that in granting cert, the court itself characterizes the right as the one person, one vote principle of the 14th Amendment as evidenced in Reynolds and Hadley. I'm not going to try and summarize all of the cases that have been decided since Reynolds. I think there are a couple of ideas that are worth thinking about as the court addresses the massive kind of voter discrepancies that Brad will get into. In a case in Hawaii, the court addressed the fact that Hawaii used non-population as the basis for its apportionment. And language that Texas and probably more important, the Solicitor General focus their primary attention on is the court's use of the phrase that apportionment has to be based on population. Well, in Burns, the court doesn't require the use of population. And in fact, they uphold Hawaii's use of registered voters, in large part because Hawaii decides that population is not the best indicia, in large part because of the large number of military personnel and tourists that are reflected in the census data. So, in a sense, it represents the court's recognition that population per se is not the only legitimate basis. One other case that's probably worth mentioning is the Ninth Circuit's decision in Garza versus the County of Los Angeles. And in that case, the two-judge majority over the objections of Judge Kaczynski finds that the rationale that supports the population basis as essentially the sole legitimate basis for apportionment, even where there's discrepancies in the number of eligible voters, is predicated on a theory that what Reynolds really was worried about was not voter eligibility, but the the fact of representational equality, that the Equal Protection Clause, in fact, embodied a theory of elected representatives represented equal numbers of persons, and that it is not voting per se that is the important basis for the equal rights or the equal protection argument. My take is that's probably not a fair reading of Reynolds and the progeny. Kaczynski lays out essentially that argument that the court's opinions support a voter eligibility focus and not a representational focus. So with that, I will turn it over to Brad for a recitation on what the court's going to be looking at in Evanwell.
Thanks, Dean. So Evanwell is billed as raising fundamental questions about American democracy and how the system works, but the case has really been litigated as a straightforward one-person, one-vote case under Reynolds. It deals with districts in the Texas State Senate, and stress right off the bat, this is not a case about congressional districts. That's not at issue here. What we're dealing with is Texas's division of 31 state Senate districts based entirely on the total population of Texas. This method of drawing districts is not unusual. It happens in almost every state. Here, however, the effect of equalizing total population among these 31 districts was to cause significant vote dilution, as described earlier by Dean and as conceived of in Reynolds. So when you consider the voting eligible population of Texas, some districts in this 31 districts set had 50% more voters than the ideal district if voting eligible population were divided equally among the districts. This is obviously massive vote dilution, and it leads to the basic theory of the case, which is when drawing districts based on total population leads to results like this, Texas should have and needed to consider the voting eligible population in drawing these districts. It's important to stress just from a litigation perspective here as it comes to the court, no one disputes the levels of vote dilution here. Also, nobody disputes that the information was available to Texas to demonstrate to it that this level of vote dilution existed. That data was eligible voter statistics at the our voter registration at the county level and U.S. Census Bureau calculations of so-called CVAP, citizen voting age population, something we'll talk about a little bit later. The bottom line is Texas had this data but didn't use it at all in constructing their districts. So the reason this case, a big part of the reason this case is getting so much attention is why the vote dilution happened here. And again, that why isn't really a big part of the party's briefs, but obviously why it happens is the
Have we now lost Brad Benbrook? I think we might have lost him. Dean McGrath, are you still on?
I am.
I wonder if you're not able, and we're going to try and dial back out to Brad Benbrook. And again, this is Dean Reuter of the Federalist Society. I apologize to those of you who have dialed in. We're experiencing some difficulties with the dial-in system. But Dean McGrath, do you want to take over now and continue your portion of the discussion?
Okay. A couple of things that are kind of tangentially raised in this by the Solicitor General, and one is that the one that Brad mentioned that is not really germane to the case, but the Solicitor General's office argues that there's essentially an incorporation into the Equal Protection Clause, Section 2 of the 14th Amendment's, the apportionment provisions for the House of Representatives, which by its terms is population-based. And it was in part the Justice Harlan's dissent in Reynolds that focused on Section 2 and says that it prescribes the remedy for violations. The court obviously did not follow Harlan's focus and use the Equal Protection Clause. So the other component of the Solicitor General's argument is essentially an elaboration of the Garza opinion that population is the only legitimate basis for apportionment, and they essentially use the rationale that I talked about earlier. I think they probably go a little bit too far in saying that that is the only rationale that the court has used in apportionment. And that they also then, Texas had argued that there's an opportunity for them to kind of pick the basis they want to use, relying in part on the Burns ability to select Hello?
Is that Dean McGrath?
It is. Was I coming through?
I can hear you now. We lost you for about 10 seconds there. And let me ask, while we've interrupted you, do we have Brad Benbrook on yet? Okay, well, once again, I apologize, but we can still hear you, Dean McGrath, if you'd go ahead.
Okay. I don't know where you lost me. So anyway, the SG's office is arguing that basically population is the sole basis for doing it. Texas argues that, well, we get to decide. And two of the circuits have said, yeah, that is in part the way that the court has given states flexibility. The Justice Department obviously is less than thrilled with that approach because it would allow Texas, if they decided to use eligible voters as one of the criteria. So they use and rely on the argument that population is the kind of core principle inherent in the Equal Protection Clause and not voter eligibility. It kind of, their position that it's the sole basis would make it hard to adopt a position that Texas could conceivably use that would involve combining both population and eligible voter criteria. So it has a little bit of the feel that Justice is pushing it a little bit too far. Brad, you back?
We are. This is Dean Reuter. We're trying to dial out to him once again. Brad Benbrook, are you on yet? Sounds like he is not on, and I apologize. I think this is a go ahead.
Brad, it's Brad here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, and
okay, sure
once again, apologies. Well, I think it's a problem with our call-in system here, but I think Dean McGrath has now concluded his second round of comments, Brad, so we can hear you if you want to resume.
Sure. I think we may have gone beyond where I was. I apologize for that. I think the I'll pick up with the other main argument being made by the other side against the theory that's being put forth here, that voting eligible population is the relevant population to be considered when drawing districts. And that other main opposition argument is that, as a practical matter, it's too difficult to be confident that a jurisdiction drawing districts based on equal numbers of eligible voters, because the argument goes there's no reliable data on eligible voters. Now, there are two potential sources of data. One is registered voters as maintained by counties or states. Critics say that counties and states are notoriously inaccurate when it comes to tracking registered voters. I would just note that a ruling that the plaintiffs state a claim here will put a very high premium on accurate data, and that voting data might quickly become much, much more accurate. The focus, however, of the amicus briefing and a lot of the articles out there dealing with this practical argument focuses on the second source of voting-related data, and that is the Census Bureau's CVAP data, citizen voting age population. This information is gathered from the American Community Survey. The ACS is a survey of 3.5 million households annually. It gathers a lot of demographic data. It replaced the census long form. And the critics say if you're going to look at CVAP data and use CVAP data to draw districts, that the first problem is that it's based on estimates. They say it's basically like a huge poll with an associated margin of error. The second argument they make is that it's not as up-to-date as the decennial census numbers, in the sense that the most accurate information about CVAP is based on 5-year rolling averages. And third, they argue that when you're dealing with small jurisdictions, the margin of error increases and makes it more difficult to be confident that you're accurately drawing these districts. And that's where our brief came in. Dean and I represented demographers who engage in redistricting every 10 years, and our brief showed that this CVAP data can and already is used in redistricting around the country. We point out many of the uses for which ACS and CVAP data are put, including the federal government distributes roughly $450 billion per year in funding based on ACS data. But most important, the most important point, I think, in our brief, apparently I've dropped again, so I apologize if people can hear me.
No, we could hear you right up to the most important thing in your brief.
Okay, the most important point is I think that CVAP data is used in nearly every lawsuit under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when the parties are trying to determine the voting population of minorities that are allegedly being diluted. These cases and those litigation matters trust CVAP to tell courts down to a tenth of a percentage point what the voting population is for a particular district. Now, everyone knows these cases are very hotly contested, a lot is at stake, yet people trust this very data that they say can't be trusted for one person, one vote, to give them the answers in those Section 2 cases. And frankly, the other side has no answer for this. We explain how CVAP data can be used just like total population to draw districts. As for the inaccuracy point as well, we also note, and I think it's worth noting here, that the court has stressed for one person, one vote cases, perfection is not the standard. You can't literally make districts equal in size. So among other things, they've developed a 10% threshold to deal with these litigation cases. In the end, the practical argument that's made is it does seem unusual, an unusual position to take, basically saying, yes, the Equal Protection Clause protects against vote dilution, and yes, nobody disputes that the vote dilution here is very significant and could have been reduced, but court, don't do anything about it because future cases may be hard to decide because the data isn't perfect now. Finally, I would just note for listeners out there, there are a lot of terrific resources about the case. There's just an avalanche of articles from the left, but I would encourage you to read Cato's briefs, both at the cert stage and at the merit stage. John Eastman has written a couple of great briefs as well, dealing with the Indians not taxed phrase in the Constitution, among other things, and also great coverage at Heritage by Andrew Grossman and Hans von Spakowski. So, Dean Reuter, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, thank you very much. Speaking of Andrew Grossman, let me, before we turn it over to questions to the audience, just remind folks or alert folks to the fact that tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be talking about this case again, reviewing the oral argument, and that conversation will be led by Andrew Grossman. For today, let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open. I, again, want to apologize for the technical difficulties we've had. A lot of you have held in here for the Q&A portion, so please do feel free to ask questions by pushing star and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me continue on with our regular announcement about upcoming calls. In addition to the call tomorrow at 2 p.m. On the Evenwell case discussing the oral argument, on Wednesday at 2 p.m. we'll be talking about the Fisher case. That's the affirmative action case being argued again in the Supreme Court. Then on Thursday, it's the Harris case on who counts towards redistricting. Another Supreme Court case. And then Friday, something that doesn't involve a Supreme Court case, at least not directly, the new book by David Savage with Paul Rosenzweig. It's an insider's account of the war on terror. Today, of course, the Evenwell preview. Push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any questions right off the bat, but let me ask Brett, if you want to talk a little bit more maybe about the interaction between this case and the Voting Rights Act.
Sure. Briefly, the part of the reason for the very intense interest from so many groups is their concern about what a ruling for plaintiffs here would mean for, in the future as a practical matter for Section 2 cases and drawing districts in general, because the more factors you consider in various priorities, the more difficult it becomes to achieve your priorities, depending on what they are. And from a straight legal perspective, however, what the appellants here point out is that the case could have, if Texas wins, it would have profound implications for the Voting Rights Act, because the Voting Rights Act is expressly premised as a way to protect minority voting strength under the Equal Protection Clause. And if the court changes course and says, no, the Equal Protection Clause is not there to protect voting strength, but the representational interest that Dean talked about, what does that mean for the ongoing effect or legitimacy of the Voting Rights Act? So that that is obviously a significant point that is raised in the briefs. At the cert stage, Cato filed a brief showing the tension where courts impose rulings under Section 2 that can't be justified under one-person, one-vote principles. That is, in order to reach a particular result under Section 2, the courts require the drawing of districts that afterward end up violating one-person, one-vote as normally understood. At the cert stage, they colorfully described this case as highlighting the bloody crossroads of one-person, one-vote and the Voting Rights Act.
Once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. I don't see any callers with questions right now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. I'm hoping the call-in system is working. Let me ask another question while we see if the audience is going to weigh in. Is this this week is being described as one of the most important weeks of the term, with some of the most talked about cases, this case, the Fisher case, the Harris case. Is this, in your minds, a particularly controversial case, a particularly difficult case? Is it going to cause a lot of disagreement in the court? Or do you have anything you want to say along those lines? That's a question for either of you.
I'll jump in, Dean.
Okay. Well, first of all, the characterization of weeks as the most important in the Supreme Court's term probably is overworked and applies to way too many of the weeks. To a certain extent, I think I agree that with some of the analysts that from a narrow kind of legal interpretation, that if you follow Reynolds versus Sims and the theoretical basis for voting equality as the fundamental part of the Equal Protection Clause that the court used to justify its application of equal protection to state apportionment, then you're hard-pressed to say that you're required to exclude voting as a component of apportionment. I think it's a little bit broader to say that it's the only factor, because the Supreme Court has on repeated occasions indicated that there are other criteria include compactness of the district, recognition of, you know, historic components, counties, cities, whatever. But I think in that sense, I think it's hard for the court to exclude voting as an applicable criteria, whether it's the sole enforceable right. My guess is that there will be some tension in the court over how far to go with that. Brad, I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, I think, this case really just teed up the question of the extent to which the voting eligible population should or must be considered, and the other factors are kind of in the background as things that may be considered, but not as a matter of Equal Protection Clause jurisprudence. And, you know, I think unless there's just a complete punt, it will be very difficult for the courts to write an opinion that explains why, without just really, really changing Reynolds, it would need to explain why these levels of vote dilution that nobody disputes aren't a problem under the Equal Protection Clause in Reynolds.
Once again,
the punt would be along the lines of the political question in quotes approach that some courts, including the three-judge district court did here, which I think Dean may have mentioned when I was off the line, really was already handled in Baker versus Carr. So go ahead, Dean Reuter.
Yeah, I was going to thank you. We do have a question from our audience, so let's take our first call of the day now.
Yes, it's David Emerson, a society member here in Berkeley. And, you know, I apologize if this question has already been discussed because the call's been dropping off and on throughout. My question, it's either for Dean or Brad, actually, is that, you know, depending on how this turns out at the court, what do you see as potentially a next step as terms of voting dilution? And is there any concern about the voting dilution analysis extending to specific groups, you know, groups that may be historically or, you know, provably statistically diluted, and the interaction of that with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and potentially even, you know, ending up in kind of a disparate impact analysis where the burden would shift to defend the voting, I guess, the voting calculus to defend against the claim that there was a disparate impact against some of the disadvantaged groups.
Well, I think just as a straightforward litigation type matter, I mean, the one person, one vote cases really talk about district by district without regard to race. What is a voter in this district? How is that person's vote weighted compared to voters in another district? And then Section 2 is the statutory overlay that says in order to protect the rights, the equal protection rights of certain groups, they will have the statutory claim against dilution. I think the next cases, so to speak, if the court says that the plaintiffs have stated a claim here, the next cases will be dealing with many of the logistical questions of which types of population should be considered, and what are the tolerances for deviations among the districts with that information. As we mentioned, I think earlier, in traditional one person, one vote cases, the court has already said we'll tolerate up to a 10% deviation among the districts because we recognize that the districts can't be perfectly equal, and equality and perfection is not the standard given the other factors that go into redistricting. So I think that's most likely to be the next few cases. In a sense, to the extent this is viewed as not a straightforward application of Reynolds, the case could almost be looked at as a modern version of Baker versus Carr, which says, yes, these cases are, they do state a claim. Now people go out and litigate them.
This is Dean McGrath. In part, I mean, obviously the history behind Reynolds was the use of kind of various subterfuges to discriminate based on race in the apportionment cases. The straightforward rationale is that it's the voters' interest. And that's what the court used in Reynolds. And because they didn't use it entirely based on race, I think they've been much more comfortable through the years granting the state some flexibility, including the 10% kind of prima facie under 10%. The burden's not on the state over that. It's kind of a kind of a modified strict scrutiny test. So I think the court will have to deal with, okay, in those cases where it is race-based, is that kind of flexibility still something we can tolerate?
Let me make a final call for questions here. This is Dean Reuter. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got a couple minutes left here. Seeing none, let me give each of our guests a chance to express any final thoughts they might have. Let's start first with Dean McGrath.
It's always interesting to find out what the court will focus on, and I make no predictions about what issues they will focus on or what the final result is. I agree with Brad that I think it's very hard for them, given where they've been in Reynolds and virtually all of the cases since then, for them to ignore the voting component of going forward. Brad?
Brad here. Well, Dean, you asked if it was the most important week of the term. I don't know about that, but I will say it is the Consovoy-McCarthy week at the term. Will Consovoy is the lawyer arguing Evenwell tomorrow, and he's also on the brief in Fisher, and I'm sure will be at council table on Wednesday. So congratulations to Will and Tom for that achievement, and thank you, Dean, for letting us talk about it today.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.